At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online. After midnight.
We died within an hour of each other. That sentence lives in the hollow of my chest like a secret I was never supposed to learn. It's not a line you expect to open a life with. And yet for me, it's the first hard fact that ever stitched itself to my bones. Boston, March 11th, 1960. 3 months old, stopped breathing. Seizure, nearly gone. Long Beach, same day. Freddie, 19, motorcycle, an oncoming car, gone on impact. Two lives severed on the same date. Two futures that began and ended in the span of an hour. That's the kind of coincidence that reads like fate, and in my case, it would read like a map. I was put up for adoption and raised by strangers who became my family. Freddie and my birth mother never had custody of me. That's the tidy corner of the story that people like. No messy biology to complicate the narrative. But biology, grief, and time don't respect neatness. They accumulate in corners of houses, in smells, in the hollow between steps. My first memory of anything that couldn't be explained was the staircase in my grandparents' beach house. I must have been five, maybe younger. The staircase was beautiful in that old-fashioned way. Varnished wood, a polished banister. Sun that pooled lazily on the treads in the afternoons. It should have been nothing but a part of a warm, noisy summer home. Instead, every time I climbed it alone, I felt a prickle of terror that began in my stomach and spread outward like cold. By the second step, I had this overwhelming urge to run, to get to the top before something got to me. I ran up those stairs for years like a child pursued by something that never showed itself. And when I finally collided with my grandmother one day, mid-flight, breathless and shaking, she laughed and told me I ran as if the devil were on my heels. You can be told you're dramatic as a child and you grow into dramatic people, but that staircase wasn't drama. That compulsion, that physical pulling, continued well into my 30s, always when I was alone. When I was a young woman, the house amplified things I didn't even know belonged to me. It prompted strange thoughts, the effortless desire to bend spoons, to move salt with a stern stare, to see if the edge of my mind could nudge matter. I was always too afraid to try. What if it worked? In my 20s, I had a friend stay over after a Saturday morning of cartoons with my daughter. She stopped halfway up the living room stairs, smiled, looked at her purse at the base of the steps, and asked, almost casually, "Do you ever feel like you can move things with your mind when you're in this house?" In that moment, I realized I wasn't alone. She would later become a working medium. That detail made the house's personality feel less like a personal failing and more like an inheritance. The house itself had a life that extended beyond our family. My grandfather had built it for decades. From the roaring 20s into the middle of the 60s, it had been a summer hive. Circus performers, poker games that ran into dawn, music, laughter. The kind of place that absorbs stories. The kind of place that can keep memories, the good ones and the raw, painful ones. Only my grandfather is known to have died there of old age. Yet even decades after he was gone, his presence answered like an echo. Years later, after he had died and my parents renovated the house, new insulation, new windows, brand new furniture, I came back with my 9-year-old daughter to live there more permanently. I had broken my ankle a week before, swollen in a cast, still not steady on my feet. I sent my daughter down to make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches while I took a shower. When I emerged, limping into my bedroom, which had once been my grandfather's room, the smell hit me so hard, I couldn't breathe. Aqua Velva, but not just any Aqua Velva. The exact way Grandpa smelled when he had been alive. The cotton candy sharpness of aftershave, a warm, tobacco-leaning undertow. It filled the room, thick and impossible. I froze, paralyzed as if glued to the thought of it. I could hear my daughter bounding up the stairs. My mind screamed that I had to act nonchalant. I had to be the adult who wasn't afraid of anything. I forced a smile into my frozen face, but I couldn't move. The plate of sandwiches flew into the air, and my daughter screamed, "Grandpapa!" And then she darted out of the room. I ran after her, bumbling down the stairs in such an ungainly rush that I bruised my backside for weeks. The smell was gone by the time my brother came. When I called him, the scent had vanished as if it had never existed. I slept that night in my daughter's room, and the next day I moved bedrooms for good. That was the beach house's way, give and take, then leave you with a question mark. Once, late at night, while I sat in my recliner watching television, and my ex-boyfriend lay on the carpet at my feet, he began to struggle in a way that made no physical sense. His arms thrashed, his head turned, his chest heaved against an invisible weight. I could see a dark, wispy cloud hovering above him, pressing down. There was an impression on his shirt like something had been lying on him. I did not move. I watched as if watching a scene out of a play where I was disengaged from emotion. He was the kind of man who could move a refrigerator up 2 flights of stairs by himself. Now he couldn't move. And then it released. The cloud drifted toward the front door and vanished, and in the way that ghosts are cruel, we both turned our heads and continued watching television like nothing had happened. Days later, while eating lunch, we replayed it as a memory we had suppressed. How many other things had been pried out of our recollection by some part of us trying to stay sane? My daughter, small and intuitive, heard things too. She would tell me about the sounds of parties on the porch at night. Laughing, music, people coming and going, only to look and find the porch empty and cold. She would say she heard crying upstairs that she felt certain was Grandma, though Grandma had died when she was 3. Children remember a kind of truth adults forget. Not everything you can't see isn't real. When I was 17, 2 big things happened. My friend's boyfriend died in a drunk driving crash, and that grief hung in the air like a storm cloud. One night in our kitchen, she called out to him, begged him to hear her, and just moments later, 6 stacked dishes fell from a shelf and crashed to the floor. The house went cold. The sound left echoes like finger trails down my spine. I remember feeling a kind of relief, like some pressure had released. It was as if the house itself had been holding its breath for some time and had finally exhaled. Later that year, after midnight and nearly asleep, a call came from a friend whose car wouldn't start. I begrudgingly went to retrieve them from a bar where bikers loomed in the parking lot. As I reached the crowd, a state trooper stepped into view, though his uniform looked like something from another era, those knee-high boots I'd later remember as strangely incomplete. Like the apparition hadn't bothered with the lower half. He was there for a moment and then simply, poof! Gone. I never told anyone what I saw that night. The crowd was loud. They would have drowned out anything anyway. Years passed. I married a practical man who scoffed a bit charmingly at my tendency to notice things that could not be measured. He would joke he'd wait to convene with the dead when he joined them. That kind of humor is a linchpin in marriages, one person serious and one person content to roll their eyes. It kept our household functioning. But it also meant I kept certain things unsaid. In May 1994, curiosity and something deeper drove me to find Freddie. I had met my birth mother at 24 and gotten fragments, a name, a vague story. The search felt like archaeology of the self. I visited Freddie's old high school, found black and white photographs, a young man with slicked back hair and a shy, wide smile. A cousin remembered him. pieces of a life I had almost lived sat in albums and memory. And then came a night that changed the whole topography of my belief. It was early summer, around 3 a.m. I woke to a light pouring into my oversized bedroom. At first, it was just brightness, then a shape emerged. A young man in jeans and a black leather jacket, red hair slicked back, ocean blue eyes. My heart did not pound. My body did not tremble with fear. Something in me knew him with the certainty of an old map. I knew, without reasoning, that this was Freddy. He beckoned and I crossed the room. As I walked, time dissolved and folded. I felt myself age backward and forward, 34 to 25 to a child of 13 to a small toddler. When I reached him, he bent, lifted me, and the world rearranged itself around that embrace. I felt myself shrink to an infant in his arms, all breath and grace. He rocked me, and for what felt like hours, maybe minutes, we held each other like people making up for decades. He smelled like oil, like gasoline and sun and something clean and new. His eyes were everything I hadn't known I'd been searching for. When he set me down, I scaled through ages again, 4, 13, 25, until I crawled back into bed as a 34-year-old who had been given a gift that would not fit into ordinary language. I woke shaking, sobbing like a child, because the loss of that encounter was immediate and visceral. The next day I drove to his grave. I walked to the exact headstone without directions, a quiet cemetery about 10 miles away. I went as if drawn. I stood in front of the stone and felt the afterglow of the dream still humming under my skin. There are moments in a life that are purely private, that if you tell them out loud, your family will file them away as eccentricities. But after Freddy, the universe started speaking to me more loudly. On April 22nd, 1996, around 1 a.m, something rushed at me like a wind. It was my mother, and then she was in me, and then she was gone. I rolled over, told my husband, my mother just died, as if reporting the weather, and went back to sleep. It was true. She died in the same moment. How is that possible? Why did I not leap to the phone, to the hospital, to any action at all? Perhaps some part of me already knew the grief would be there and there was nothing to be done. Perhaps whatever passed between us in that instant was the only goodbye we would ever need. After that, the calls began. Once, an old friend who had not spoken to me in years appeared on my caller ID at 5 a.m. When I tried to answer, there was silence, but the ID showed his number. Days later, I learned he had died the night before. Another friend called, again, after death. A pattern formed. I began to suspect that I was a receiver of messages. Small, human, terribly intimate messages from people folding out of the world. Then came 2003 and my brother's death. He had worked at a corner store, and after he died, his boss called me relentlessly for days. From what showed up on caller ID as the payphone outside the store, it was a detail that lodged in me later. Why a payphone? Why keep dialing when everyone was grieving? The call stopped after the memorial, and I carry a small, sharp regret for never picking up. Maybe he wanted me to answer. Maybe he was learning to communicate and kept trying until I was ready to listen. We moved to Salem in October 2005, a small cottage across from a lake, renovated and neat, a place you can imagine two people in the middle of life and the quiet. I loved parts of it immediately. My daughter did not. In fact, the first time she saw it, she recoiled, though she smiled as if to be polite. She complained about a terrible odor. Something stinking the house from inside the walls. And she felt driven to run out and wash the creepy off. She was 30 at the time. We have always been close. Her reaction cut through the surface calm and lodged in me like a splinter. The cottage began to show its personality. At first, it was small things. A stench would rise from nowhere and be gone moments later. The smell was intense, like something decaying, then suddenly gone. Tobacco would come and go in a non-smoking house. Whole meals would seem to stew in the air. At 3 a.m, onions and meat, steam and richness, and then nothing. A smell of soap, ivory sharp enough to make my eyes water, it would hover in the living room and be gone, like a sigh. At night, I would hear the pawing of a horse outside as if an animal in the dark had come up to the window, snorting and stamping. I would run into the yard because I loved horses and because sometimes we force ourselves to push past fear, and the darkness would press against me so heavily that my legs felt like they were moving through water. The house was close. It reached into me. The porch light looked a mile away, though it was only a few steps. I told myself I had been dreaming, that it was a nightmare grabbed from too many late-night thrillers. But you can only rationalize the body for so long. There were noises from the shed where my husband stored my late brother's record collection. Tools, music, scratching sounds, always the kind of thing you'd assume were practical, until you realized the shed was empty. Wind would gust from the refrigerator door, though no windows or doors were open. One night, my daughter, sleeping in what I'd set up as a dressing room on an air mattress, felt eyes on her and refused to stay. "Something's in there," she said the next morning, pale. "I can't sleep in that room." I'd seen enough shows to know the first step is to record. I bought a small Sony voice-activated recorder and left it in the spare room overnight. The device was an innocent piece of plastic. It captured whatever was in the room, whether I believed it or not. When I later listened during an early morning detour while my husband ran to the lumber yard and I sat in the truck with headphones on, the recordings shattered my last defenses. There it was, a child laughing, a man whispering into the microphone. On one track, a voice said, "Let me out." On another, the rough breath of a man, "I'm coming, I love you," with a heavy intake that you could feel as if it had weight. There were bangs and thuds that hadn't been audible at the time. The voices were clear, close, intimate. They could have come only from within that room. I tried hard to debunk it. I yelled in different rooms, turned on every radio and television, walked the neighborhood for someone with a massive antenna. I played tapes and compared. I taped my own voice in the same place. None of it accounted for what I had. I sat with the evidence growing heavier in my bag and lighter in my hands. I ran out to the shed in the dark, sometimes with a camera, taking pictures of nothing and everything until the neighbors thought I had lost my mind. By then I'd stopped caring. The proof had made disbelief impossible. We called them EVPS, electronic voice phenomena. The recordings were simple, blunt knocks at my door. They told me what I already suspected. Something inhabited the house. Not malevolent, not always. Sometimes affectionate, sometimes mischievous. Sometimes sad as a history, stitched into the plaster. The house was a gallery of people who had lived and loved, and perhaps of those who had never left. Or perhaps the land slept like a wound and woke up sometimes when we moved through it. Either way, the cottage, the beach house, Salem, they had a way of gathering lives like pages in a book. Over the years, the activity tapered and shifted like tides. People passed, people called from beyond. A fragrance would lift a room and then disappear. I learned to live with the ordinary and with the uncanny. I can't prove a single thing to anyone who doesn't want to believe. I can only offer memory. The smell of aqua velva that swallowed a room, the way a pizza plate can fly as if some hand has tossed it into the air. The shape of a man in the dark who holds you in his arms and makes you small and safe again. Those moments are mine. Lodged in blood and bone. If you listen for the world's small miracles, you might see them as errors, as tricks of sleep or of the mind. People will have reasons to explain away the things I tell you: allergies, drafts, the mind's hunger for story. I used to believe those things myself, but if you have a child who knows how to smell a memory in a room and reacts by running out to wash the creepy off, if you ever wake with the certainty that a person you loved has just passed through you and said goodbye from within you, then you carry knowledge that will not be soothed by skepticism. In the end, death and life braided together on a single date. I was given a second chance at 3 months. Freddie's life ended in an instant. But neither of those events was an ending. They were a beginning. Those early scenes and the crash and the resuscitation stitched me to a story that would wind through beaches and porches and broken staircases and small vibrating tape recorders. I don't know if I'm a medium or merely someone whose life has been porous at the edges. I don't know if Freddy's presence was a gift or a question, a consolation or a summons. What I do know is this. The world keeps speaking in smells and small sounds if you are willing to listen. The dead come to the living in the ways they can. Sometimes they knock. Sometimes they press down like a weight on your chest and then vanish. Sometimes they sit and hum and make the room smell like a life that once was. So I tell you this, not to frighten you. I tell it because I lived it. Because the next time you step over a second stair and feel the urge to run for no apparent reason, don't be too quick to call yourself foolish. There are house voices that speak in the language of floors and doorways. They learn the shape of your feet on the stairs and the way you breathe when you reach the top. They may be the residue of a life well lived or the echo of a single tragic hour. Either way, they will not be silenced by neat explanations. We died within an hour of each other, Freddie and I, but somehow between that motorcycle and that hospital bed, a thread was left. It tugged when I least expected it, in the smell of aftershave and in the sound of a child's laughter captured onto a plastic recorder. It tugged until I could no longer ignore it. If you ever find yourself standing in an old house at night, smelling someone long gone or listening to a recording that carries a voice that shouldn't be there, remember that not all endings are endings. Sometimes they're the opening of a strange kind of life, one that hums on the other side of ordinary things, and sometimes, in the quiet, a father can come back to hold the child he never knew and tell her, with no words at all, that she was never alone.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.